week two of the new semester of Religious Studies project already. I can hardly believe it. We're here due to the good grace of the British Association for the Study of Religion in the Bull Bar, and we're drinking some fine ales. We being myself, David Robertson, and my good friend and associate,
Christopher Carter.
Christopher Carter, the very same. What are you drinking, Chris?
It's a Jarl. Are you on the same?
No, I'm drinking Citra, but they're both similar, higher hop light ales. Anyway, without further ado, let's go straight into this week's podcast, which is with Carol Cusack, our friend and longtime collaborator, and it's on the subject of cultural production, something which I have an interest in, especially as I have a chapter appearing in the book on New Religions and Cultural Production, published by Brill, which Carol recently edited in collaboration with our other friend,
Alex Norman.
Alex Norman.
I should also mention that this is the start of a series on the broad topic of religion and cultural production, so this is a really sort of intense but light-hearted at the same time overview of the topic, and then over the next few weeks we'll be going into sort of looking at particular cultural products.
And it's a very topical, arguably quite important issue. It relates to so many other sort of themes that are going on in the field at the moment. Broadly, the linguistic or cultural turn in religious studies, which in itself is part of a broader cultural and linguistic turn within social sciences and philosophy itself, really challenging hegemony of kind of belief-based orthodoxic Protestant conceptions of religion into a more grounded and arguably fitting with the science part of the social sciences. So let's pass you over to Chris and Carol.
I am here in Edinburgh with the second of our repeat interviewees. We've had James Cox give two interviews, and now we have Professor Carol Cusack. So first off, welcome, Carol.
Thanks very much, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to be speaking with you, as always. Carol Cusack has appeared on a number of our podcasts, actually, a few roundtable discussions and a compilation podcast and a previous interview on invented religions. She is the author of a book which bears that same title, Invented Religions, which was published in 2010. Another which should come up today is The Sacred Tree, Ancient and Medieval Manifestations, published in 2011, and the most relevant to what we'll be discussing is the 2012 edited volume, The Brill Handbook of New Religions and Cultural Production, which is co-edited with Alex Norman. And today we're going to be talking about the broad topic of religion and cultural production. So now that I've got my introduction out of the way, what is cultural production before we start talking about religion and cultural production?
One of the great difficulties always is defining anything, and I know throughout the history of the RSP the question of how you define religion and what sorts of things you want religion to do or to be about has arisen in almost every single discussion. I'm taking culture, my co-editor Alex Norman and I took culture, to be largely material products when we did the Brill Handbook and cultural production. And we started off with the idea that nowadays, if you go to a museum or an art gallery, a temple of high culture in the Western world, in the non-Western world, you will see examples of material culture that were made by people who belonged to particular religious traditions. And we in the West may appreciate them as art or as historical artifact, and a whole discipline of museology or what's called cultural heritage management has arisen around these objects. And indeed, some very good scholars have asked questions like, what does it mean for a religious object? Let's just say for a very simple one, a chalice, which would have been used in the Catholic Mass in the Middle Ages, to no longer be used in a church, but to be placed in a glass cupboard in a museum where people look at it and they may appreciate it not as a chalice, because they may in fact not really even understand what a Catholic Mass was about or how you would use a chalice in that way, but they may appreciate it as a piece of silverwork, as something that is jewel encrusted, as beautiful. They may appreciate it only because of its financial value, because it's precious metal, precious stone, etc. So we started off thinking there are these objects that we might call religious objects, however problematic that is, and they occupy certain spaces, but they can occupy different spaces. Because we both work in new religions and contemporary religions most of the time, we were concerned by the idea that possibly nobody would really want to put, for example, 15 different garishly coloured Hare Krishna t-shirts into a museum, where they would want to put the lovely 16th or 15th century Catholic chalice. And that brought us to the idea that not all religions are equal, which the RSP acknowledges. We've already had lots of people discussing problematic questions about how come some religions are called world religions and some religions are excluded from that. Some religions are not even appreciated as religions at all. People are always contesting them legally. So Alex and I said, the cultural products of religions are not equal either. And so cultural products in the context of my work on religion would include things like music, clothing, architecture, books, paintings, sculptures, sometimes everyday life artifacts like weapons or kitchen utensils, if they're used specifically in religious context for that particular community. And I guess what we were trying to work when working on new religions and cultural production was to look at the way that some of these more numerically small and more contested religious groups in the contemporary world were nevertheless producing extraordinary culture, and the way in which often it went unremarked because the people who received that cultural product didn't realise it was actually out of a religious milieu.
Right.
That's very lengthy and complicated. And I'm sorry.
No. That's exactly what we're wanting. You just hit on exactly what I was about to ask there. So, like, how do we know that a cultural product is a cultural product of religion? Is it down to the intentions of the person who made it? Does it have to be made by an institution? Who decides? And if it is sort of down to intention, how as a scholar do you work out what these intentions are?
That's a huge question. Yeah. And being where I am just historically, when I began university in 1981, the death of the author was a big theme, and I studied literature. I have an honours degree in English as well as religious studies. And the idea that you could discern authorial intention, or that even the maker of something could fix the meaning of an object or a text, was something that I was educated at a point where that was vehemently denied. And I still think I have to stand with that. Another cult film when I was an undergraduate was The Gods Must Be Crazy. And I think some listeners may have heard of it. If you haven't, it's really worth seeing. But it's about the effect that a Coke bottle falling out of a helicopter and hitting an African tribesman, I think one of the bushmen of the Kalahari, and the way that the Coke bottle becomes a fetishized, valuable object in his culture. It's incredible, and it's actually, I think, very instructive for students in religious studies. So I think I want to steer a neither-nor and either-or path with that question. Yeah. Because if you think about Gurdjieffian films, for example, firstly, you've got the problem, is the Gurdjieff work a religion? Was G.I. Gurdjieff actually a religious teacher? And that's hugely contested. Mm-hmm. Maybe he was a spiritual teacher. Maybe he was an esotericist. Maybe it is religious. Maybe it's a self-help technology. Who knows? And then Gurdjieffian films, well, Meetings with Remarkable Men, made by Peter Brook in 1979. That's actually a film that was made by a Gurdjieffian from one of Gurdjieff's own books, and in various ways is actually quite faithful to the literary text and attempts to evoke a sense of mystery and respect and awe for the figure of Gurdjieff. So I think you could say that's a Gurdjieffian film. But the interesting thing is it was intended for non-Gurdjieffian audiences as well as for Gurdjieffian audiences. It was intended for anyone who wanted to look at the idea of an enlightened teacher and be inspired by it. Something like Alejandro Jodorowsky's The Holy Mountain, which is an extraordinary hallucinogenic film, which is also profoundly Gurdjieffian in lots of ways, I think passes totally under the radar as a Gurdjieffian film, because most people don't know that Jodorowsky studied under Claudio Naranjo and Oscar Ichazo, and they don't recognise the Enneagram, the Gurdjieffian symbol, when it appears in the film. They don't know that it was based on an obscure, incomplete Gurdjieffian novel, Mount Analog, by René Dalmau. So, in some senses, what happens when you read, when you look at Meetings with Remarkable Men, is it's backed up. It's got the text, it's got the director belonging to the group, it's all authenticated. It's like holding out a Catholic missal and a Catholic chalice and saying, these are Roman Catholic objects, and everyone would go, yeah, okay. When you look at Holy Mountain, it's like, who's reading what into it? And in some sense, maybe recognising it as a cultural product of an alternative spirituality or an alternative religious milieu is an elite attribution, something that only scholars really would do.
Indeed, but then you never know what experience, well, no, I don't want to throw that word experience in there, but individuals could be taking that product and using it in a variety of different ways. So I guess that is one of the many things that you could study through this sort of framework of looking at the cultural products of religion. Perhaps at this point it would be helpful maybe to take an example. I know that you, I'm not going to pronounce it correctly, but in the book itself, you wrote about Rudolf Steiner's...
Goethe Arnhem.
There we go. I avoided having to pronounce it. But maybe just an example of a product and what you can do with that, you know, whether it's looking at the actual product itself and then what people have done with it and how it has been interpreted just through this framework.
Okay, the Goethe Arnhem is a really good example. And in one reason the Brill Handbook of New Religions and Cultural Production came about was because Alex and I have a long-standing fascination with Rudolf Steiner, but we also know that anthroposophy and Steiner's oeuvre is so enormous that it's very hard to get a grip on, and neither of us are really Steiner scholars. So we thought it would be a terrific way to write pieces that were meaningful and interesting about Steiner, not from an insider point of view, but from a proper scholarly, external, scientific, as I love our friends in Europe always say, the scientific study of religion, insofar as we can get to whatever that means. And so I picked Goethe Arnhem, and he picked biodynamic viticulture, because we like wine, and I like architecture.
I'm just about to pour another glass of wine.
That's a very good idea. But the other reason was that I'd been to visit the Goethe Arnhem in December 2009. It's in a village called Dornach, just outside of Basel. And it's one of those interesting places that is set up as a spiritual centre, deliberately. And all the buildings there in the sort of compound, really, though it's not fenced and anybody can park and walk around these buildings and look at them. The buildings reflect Steiner's cosmological principles, his teaching about human development, some of the gardens, some of the water features also enact Steinerian notions in landscape. It's a really quite strange place. And so the Goethe Arnhem is actually the second building of that name. The original Goethe Arnhem was a building made of wood which was burned, probably arson, by someone hostile to Steiner's teaching. because he formed the Anthroposophical Society in 1912 as a breakaway from theosophy. And initially he'd been going to build this Goetheanimus Center in Germany, but eventually a wealthy dentist who was an anthroposophist offered him the land and the means to do it, and it was built in Dornach. And it was built as a temple, sort of, for eurythmy, the Steinerian movement art, which embodies cosmological principles and assists in human spiritual development. And after a eurythmy demonstration, it was actually burned to the ground. And this was a total disaster for Steiner. In fact, it was very close to the end of his life. And he was almost in despair that it would ever be able to live again, to be reborn. But before he died, he left the plans for Goetheanum II, the building that you see now when you go there. And it's a remarkable building. It's in moulded concrete, quite different from the original wooden Goetheanum. It's drenched in colour. The stained glass windows are all made according to anthroposophical colour theory. Most of it, people like myself, non-initiated, non-anthroposophists, are able to go into. There are some parts that are kept private. But when you go to Dornach to look at the Goetheanum, it brings up another question about these cultural products. I've already been talking a little bit about insider and outsider views and how the scholar stands outside and might mean different things to an insider, and there might be bits that only an insider is allowed to see, etc., etc. But the friend who took me to see the Goetheanum, Mark Lauer, whom I've known for a long time and who was living in Basel, actually didn't know anything about Steiner, had never heard of anthroposophy, but he was an Australian living in Switzerland, and people said, "Oh, have you gone to see the Goetheanum?" Because it had become a tourist attraction. It was something that people wanted to see just because it was remarkable and odd, and it drew people to it. And naturally, it creates industry for Dornach, the small village, which is not entirely anthroposophical, but a good deal of it supports anthroposophists. And he said that he had been up there and taken friends to see it on several occasions, but it was quite different to go with me, because I was walking around with him and saying, "And you see, this is because the stream looks like that because it's the spiral from Bernoulli, you know, the mathematician." Mark is a mathematician, he knows. "Oh, Bernoulli, what's he got to do with that?" It's got to do with this, and the Goetheanum is done in these particular colours, are in this graded order because they work on the spiritual capacities of humans in certain ways. And it's one of those things. So the Goetheanum is just a beautiful building that anyone might want to go and see, and I include anyone being not educated people, scholars, whatever, just people who are travelling in the region might think it was worth stopping to look at it, just like it would be worth stopping to look at the Taj Mahal or Chartres Cathedral. But the Goetheanum is also, on the insider view, a special place for anthroposophists that only they have certain kinds of experiences in, and maybe they have certain kinds of very nuanced interpretations of. And for someone like me, it's interesting because it's a single site or a single object, though it's a very big one, I mean, big building. Earlier on, when you had your material religion podcast, there was a discussion about the difference between the small object that somebody has as a personal talisman or keeps in their bag and the big object, like a building, which lots of people relate to in different ways. Goetheanum is an object, but it's a really big one and very, very polysemic in its meanings. But it also enters into this popular cultural discourse of tourism and a selling, unique selling point for the local village.
And ties in with Alex's spiritual tourism probably quite nicely as well.
Well, indeed, this is the whole thing, and this is another thing that kind of drove our interest in a lot of the stuff that we put in when we invited friends to take part in this book. We wanted to cover different geographical areas and different kinds of things. And we wanted to cover self-conscious art production. So, for example, Steiner built, when the anthroposophists built the second Goethe Arnhem on the ashes of the first Goethe Arnhem. That was an intentional act to create a certain kind of cultural product.
Okay.
But Alex's example of biodynamic wine making, he was more interested in the end where it's almost totally left the Steinerian circle. And all the biodynamic winemakers, some of them are hippies and some of them are permaculture people and some of them just want to be able to say to their consumers, this is an organic product, there are no chemicals. You know? And so mostly the biodynamics is applied, but it's not traced back to Steiner, mm-hmm. and it's not seen as having Steinerian cosmological or spiritual values at all. So those two are kind of at the far end, because anthroposophists themselves use biodynamic agriculture, but they generally don't make wine. So it's just one of those areas where it had slipped. And the third piece that we had in the book on anthroposophy, which was Liselotte Frisk's piece on the Steiner Waldorf education system, mm-hmm. that's another very interesting kind of cultural product, because it takes place in specific locations. And it's a curriculum, and it's also a kind of conceptualization of children and children's learning. But it's often elected by parents who aren't anthroposophists.
Exactly. Yeah.
They just like the idea that it's an alternative system, there's freedom, there's creativity, mm-hmm. they don't want their kids going to either a church school or a state school. They want the kids to develop at their own rate, mm-hmm. and to learn, you know, practical life skills as well as reading, writing, and arithmetic.
Mm.
And so they may just say, well, Rudolf Steiner, hardly even know who he is, but we know these schools are really good.
Mm.
It's good for our kid.
So we've been talking, there we've ended up going to this sort of end of the spectrum where there's a product consciously created which can then be utilised by... Or viewed or enjoyed by others who aren't interpreting it in that same way, maybe aren't attaching anything of religious or spiritual significance to it. I was doing scare quotes there. But if we go to the other end of the spectrum, to maybe bring in your work on the sacred tree, we have here, you know, these are trees. They're not. No one's made them.
They're natural objects. They exist in the environment.
Yet, through a whole variety of processes, they can become, you know, religious symbols. So maybe you could talk a bit about that and how those would fit into the whole cultural product idea.
Well, that's another subject that has come up, I think, in the Material Religion podcast as well. There was a discussion of what are called object-oriented ontologies or object-oriented philosophies. And another one of our chapters in here, Jenny McFarlane's chapter about the pectoral cross that belonged to Charles Webster Leadbeater, the notorious theosophist, her chapter's actually called The Agency of the Object. And she makes quite a strong argument that this object, this pectoral cross, has agency, not in the sense of personhood, but in the sense that it impacts people, so they react to it in certain ways. It is not merely a passive piece of metal that people project their ideas onto. And I guess this is where the cultural production issue gets a bit tricky, because sacred trees, I've been interested in sacred trees forever, and that book that came out in 2011, it was probably the most embarrassing piece of my academic career, because I'd written published my first paper on it in 1998, and it took me 13 years,
yep,
to pull the whole thing together. I used to fitfully work on bits of it, and I used to think, what's this going to be like? What's it going to look like? What's the shape of it for? Because I didn't want to write something that was a kind of drippy, hippie pan to nature, even though, in fact, in lots of ways, my green credentials are reasonably good. I can't drive, etc., etc. We don't own a car. But I wanted to think about trees, and I wanted to get something that had a really strong theoretical orientation. It's quite funny, a couple of the reviews that have been published of it have said, actually, this book is a real problem because it's not really about trees, it's about interpretations of trees and what people think they're all about, not the trees themselves.
Well,
so there you go, I'm stuck.
Is that a problem?
I'm stuck between a rock and a hard place. But I was interested in the idea, because a word that you used, I think you've already used it once, you might have used it twice today, is symbol. It's another one of those horribly tricky words where we think, well, what does it mean? If you do etymology, it comes from Greek, symbolein, two things thrown together or juxtaposed together in a slightly incongruous way so that it becomes more memorable or more kind of sticks with you. A lot of it has to do with what people project onto the non-human as well as what the non-human might have as agency. And so people in ancient cultures in particular used to think of trees as being alive and as containing persons. And this is a view that you might find in some surviving indigenous cultures nowadays. But if you look just at things like classical Greek and Roman mythology, there were spirits who lived, dryads, who lived in trees, and their lives were coterminous with the life of the tree. If someone chopped the tree down, the dryad died. So trees were people. And so what I mostly shaped the book around was two things that trees were used for in various Indo-European mythological complexes. And one was as a model for the universe, so it was what's called the imago mundi, an image of the universe, which is something that's a little bit odd. I think people nowadays think that's a bit odd because they may not be aware of the textual sources for it. But many universes in ancient mythologies had a sort of humanoid shape, and there was a macrocosm-microcosm relationship between the universal cosmos and the human. And in the study of sacred trees, the human gets mapped onto the tree because trees look like humans and aren't like humans. You get some complicated things going on there. But the second thing I was interested in was the idea of the tree as a locator of the centre, the thing that stops territory from being faceless and directionless and unformed, but says this is the centre of the terrain that matters to us. And that's something that you find more in Irish mythology than in any of the other, where you see the five sacred trees of Ireland and how they're sites of inaugurations of kingship, and they're usually said to be things like 54 miles high, because what they're doing is taking the view that if the tree laid down like a clock hand and drew the circle around it, it would be the territory that was belonged to the king who was inaugurated under the tree. And of course, the bringing down of those trees is often associated with the falls of dynasties and royal families, because the tree somehow embodies the royal power and the terrain over whom the royal person has authority.
So I guess one of the big things I'm getting here is that a cultural product isn't necessarily a physical object. It can be an idea. It can be, ascribing characteristics to certain things is a product of culture. Would that be something that maybe differentiates this approach from material religion, would you see religion and cultural production as a form of material religion?
Okay. This is something I've been thinking about for a long, long time, since I think I was an undergraduate, because religious studies has gone through incredible number of traumatic reformulations in the last 30-odd years, more than 30
paradigms.
Years. Paradigms getting exploded, new paradigms being proposed, those paradigms failing. Something I was always interested in, probably before I even thought about writing about architecture or about other kinds of objects, I was always very interested in archaeology. And this is something I owe to my ex-husband, Jonathan Wooding, who when we were young, was something of an early medieval archaeologist, and he always tried to explain to me how hard it was to build convincing, appropriate, non-wildly speculative hypotheses about objects that were not accompanied by texts.
Mm-hmm.
And even when I was very young, and I don't think I was as aware of some of the debates that have keep turning up in the RSP, how to define religion, for example, to move it away from this propositional content, doctrinal ascent, and think about the way that it's lived or it's vernacular or it's material. One of the problems is that we still keep looking at the material object and trying to define it in terms of a text or in terms of some kind of story. And another one of the big battles that was being fought when I was an undergraduate was about the status of ritual. Now, at the moment, ritual's in a bit of an ascendant,
mm-hmm.
because it fits into the non-dogmatic, material, lived things mm-hmm. people do kind of bracket. But back then, in the early 80s, people were still trying to argue about whether ritual meant anything and what it actually meant to say that rituals meant anything. And one of the most amazing books, it's still an amazing book, is Fritz Stahl's book, Exploring Mysticism, which one of my teachers used to call Ignoring Mysticism, because Stahl's contention, and he's written a lot on ritual as well, mostly in a context of the Indian subcontinent, was that they were actually meaningless. They were just stuff people did, and all the meaning was actually projected upon it, or kind of some kind of accretion, like barnacles on a hull, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have anything to do with where it actually started. And I think when we try to think about the production of culture and we think about material religion, one of the things that always strikes me is that, yes, culture can be produced by religions at what we might call a very popular or vernacular level. But strangely enough, religions tend to engage in the production of elite culture.
Mm.
And this, I know this is awfully contentious. Whoever writes a reply to this podcast is going to say, you're completely wrong here, and I'm willing for them to say that, because I'm still trying to think this one through myself. But because I've been very interested recently in new religions and the kind of culture that they produced, I spent a lot of time looking at new religious culture.
Hmm.
And most of it isn't popular at all. Most of it is stuff that about six people at any one time is ever going to be interested in. And that takes me back to the high cultural stuff, which grows out of older historical religions. Now, there are popular forms, obviously, but if one thinks about Bach cantatas and the St. Matthew Passion and Handel's Messiah, they're all Christian. Okay, let's think about some other things that aren't Christian. The Chola bronzes from the south of India, or Kavali music from Pakistan. All of these things are seen as beautiful and remarkable, but they're high art forms.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the things that perhaps separates out the sort of work that Alex Norman and I are interested in is that issue that it's not really vernacular. That mostly what we're interested in is those products that are ideologically laden, that are filled with ideas and concepts, yeah. and that actually invite exegesis.
That would be labelled as culture, maybe with a capital C.
Kultur in the German sense.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, that's it. That's a good summary. A good way of thinking about it. There are two things I want to get to before time runs out. One is, I know that you've also, I've read at least one, if not two, papers that you've written about celebrity. I wondered just how you could maybe apply this cultural production idea to, well, obviously we do have religious celebrities, definitely, but maybe the sort of more, we'll say, secular culture of celebrity and how that could be seen in the same framework.
I think there are ways that you could make these two concepts talk to each other. When I was younger, I was actually a terrible snob, and I wasn't interested in celebrity. I always thought that that was a kind of terrible, crassly vulgar sort of thing, and I've often been teased, my ex-husband used to tease me, that when I was young, the bands I liked were the kind of bands that had audiences that would fit in a telephone booth.
Mm-hmm.
That would be where they play their gig. But as I got older, I realised that that was really stupid, and it grew out of my own background as a working class Irish Catholic in Australia in the 60s as a child with parents who'd left school at 15, and I became a relentless self-educator, an autodidact, and I wanted to understand high cultural forms because I understood their value as a commodity, that they would make me somebody different, if you like. And in an odd way, even though many people might dispute this, they have, because learning to appreciate opera or ballet or to read A Dance to the Music of Time by Anthony Powell or whatever actually does, every activity that you engage with does transform you to an extent.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm much more comfortable now about being a working class Irish Catholic girl from Sydney at 50 than I was at 16, when I thought it was just absolutely not the right place to be. So, celebrity. When did I decide that it was worth thinking about? I read an article by Rodney Stark, who is one of those litmus paper figures in religious studies. Love him or hate him, Rodney captures us all at various points. And the other thing that's interesting is he's written about so many weird things, and not things that you would necessarily think about just instantly as being something he was concerned about. He wrote an article about medieval saints. Now, he's not a medievalist. Why did he write an article about medieval saints? He'd done a number crunching on medieval saints' hagiographies for class and social status. And he published an article which said, almost every person canonised by the medieval Catholic Church was an aristocrat. And there were a couple of, you know, peasanty saints who were occasionally let in, but nearly everyone was from a royal family, a titled family, a moneyed family, and it was possible, you know, and they became... And then that hit me, because I'd been very interested in Colin Campbell for a long time. He's one of my favourite scholars. And I liked his idea that Romanticism harnessed the human imagination so that people would have emulative fantasy. And emulative fantasy is what you have when you look at the Kardashians, if you're a teenage girl, or when you look at celebrity generally. You want to emulate these people, i.e. it's driven somewhat, not even by envy, that's too strong a word. It's more like you want to imagine yourself in that space that they're imagining alternative realities. Celebrity is a primary site of cultural production in the modern West. It's not necessarily religious, mostly it isn't, but it's ubiquitous in the culture that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays we're probably more likely to be interested in the opinions of a celebrity than the opinions of an expert.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways we've moved beyond that expertise culture that was still valorised probably into about the 1970s. I tend to see 1980 as a bit of a watershed. I think it's probably because of the stage of my life I was at then. But it does seem to me that what's happened is that mediatisation, the 1982 was the year that the personal computer was heralded as the man of the year.
Mm-hmm.
1989 is the year of the launch of the World Wide Web interface, which suddenly made computing not something that only geeks could do, but kind of opened the whole thing up. Where was I going with that? Well, I'd say celebrities become much, much more ubiquitous and all-permeating in that last 30-odd years. And so it is a prime site of culture and of production of cultural forms for all of us. And so religious celebrity, very important. Celebrities who adopt religions for short periods of time, mm-hmm. or adopt certain symbols or the red strings for Kabbalah, mm-hmm. when Madonna, sometimes known as Esther, first became involved in that. The Dalai Lama and the very heavy investment that Hollywood has made in Tibetan Buddhism in particular, in terms of major films that portray the life of the Dalai Lama, but also the way in which, again, Hollywood has made films that reflect Buddhist ideas and states without being explicitly about Buddhism or trying to educate you, is one of the sites I suppose we could talk about from that point of view. Music, which we haven't even mentioned, that there's an enormous amount of religious popular music.
Just think of, you know, Bob Marley or, you know, anything like that. I'll not get you on to reggae.
My utter obsession with Rastafarianism must not be allowed to be unleashed here. But just think, George Harrison's My Sweet Lord, it's a paean to Krishna.
Bob Dylan had an interesting phase.
When he became a born-again Christian, yes. Kate Bush studied under various Gurdjieffian teachers and name checks Gurdjieff in a number of her songs. Somebody like Mike Oldfield virtually creates the genre of New Age music. And the interesting thing about that is that that's a popular form of serialist, minimalist and ambient classical music, which nobody wants to listen to, but once you popularise it, it becomes palatable for a different kind of audience who don't know anything about Schoenberg or, I don't know, Philip Glass. But it doesn't matter.
See, every single question here probably could be an individual podcast in itself.
I've already decided that I don't have enough years to live to write on all the things I'm currently interested in.
David's going to hate me for asking one more question, because we're going to go beyond his half... Well, we're well beyond his half-hour cut-off mark already, but I'm going to ask it anyway, and I'm sure he will, because it's you. He'll be like, it's fine. I have to ask, religious studies as a discipline, or as a field... I think I'll say as a field, and that's the way I prefer to speak about it at the moment, but religious studies, anyway, in the academy. Can it, or indeed more broadly, the whole idea of the secular academy be seen as a cultural product of a, say, particular form of Christianity?
Beautiful question. I'm sure David will forgive us. But even if he doesn't, I will say mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa, and be done with it. Okay. Yes, obviously, but this is one of the problems. When you opened up that thing about cultural products could be ideas earlier, there's always this tension between the notion that there is a thing in itself, Ding and Zicht, which we all now know that the politically correct thing to say is no, there isn't, because if you say there is, you're an essentialist, and that's a bad thing, capital letters. And there are representations of the thing in itself. And this is very Platonic. It goes all the way back to Platonic ideas about the forms and the manifestations, which are ephemeral, but they somehow dimly reflect the reality of the real. Academic disciplines, as we understand them, everywhere, there's an argument about whether do they explore and expose things that are already there, or do they actually create them? I know you started off as a scientist, a science student, so you will know that is still a passionate row in mathematics. Does mathematics uncover things that are there in the cosmos, or is it in fact an enormous esoteric, sprawling hall of mirrors that humans have overlaid on the world?
Yeah, like in Darren Aronofsky's film Pi, where they talk about the spiral being everywhere, and the spiral, the perfect mathematical symbol.
Well, the golden mean, which is supposed to make architectural proportions particularly harmonious to the eye.
Yeah.
Or even the proportion of the
Yeah, the forearm and the bicep.
Vitruvian Man by Leonardo da Vinci.
Mm-hmm.
It's this stuff really interests me. And I always think that we need to be dragged back to the idea that maybe there is something real there. But actually today I'm going to answer you as if there isn't, because I think that the entire kind of curriculum of a liberal arts degree, of a science degree, these things are cultural products. Even the idea that there's a canon, that there's some religions, whatever they are, that we should know about. That if we were to go out into the labour market and say we had a major in religious studies and we didn't, for example, know what the five pillars of Islam were or something like that, that, my government in Australia would feel very, very justified in withdrawing your funding instantly. Mm-hmm. What on earth have you educated these people to know if they don't know any of that sort of stuff? And so there's a kind of default position. And religious studies, this is a discussion I have often with some colleagues. Everybody seems to think that religious studies is a particular site, a particular flashpoint, where everything is rendered that much more immediate or difficult or problematic. I've always argued that it really isn't any different
from any other,
from English literature or geography or whatever, that it's that all those disciplines suffer exactly the same kinds of tensions and and unresolvable problems. So yes, religious studies in the academy is the cultural product as well as the genealogical offspring in Foucauldian terms of liberal Christianity. But just as the Enlightenment was the child of the Reformation, which was the child of medieval Christianity, which was the child of Rome, which was,
does it really matter?
Well, no, I think it does matter. Yeah. I love the idea of those kinds of family trees. But in some ways, I think this is one of the problems with a lot of what passes for theoretical reflection nowadays. It's interesting to say, and you can play with such ideas, but ultimately it doesn't take you very far.
On that, we'll say enigmatic, sort of challenging as well, note. I'm going to end this here because we could talk for hours. But people have lives and can't spend their whole time listening to religious studies podcasts. So, Carol, thanks so much for the conversation. And listeners, you can find plenty more information through Carol's academia.edu page and through our page that will accompany this podcast. So thanks, Carol.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Wonderful.
Well, that was a fascinating interview. I'm sure there's stuff to talk about. First of all, I want to mention next week's interview, continuing the series, is with Pauline Chung. What's the subject again?
Yes, I recorded this at the Digital Media and Sacred Text Conference, which is another Open University.
And organised by Tim Hutchings, who provided last week's response.
Exactly, exactly. Another good friend of the project. It's on religion, religious authority, and social media. So I was particularly interested in this. You know, one of the very first lectures I had at Edinburgh was with Hannah Oldschneider, and we were talking about, it was Judaism, you know, the sort of standard world religion approach. And something came up, and it just stuck with me the whole way through, was the idea that, let's say, because of the internet, now you have these, say, Orthodox rabbis in Israel who might not have a particular voice internationally, who now are influencing the practice of Jews all over the world. And, you know, actually, although everyone thinks of the internet as being a sort of democratizing thing, which opens everything up and means that you've got new vistas to explore, actually, when authority comes into it, sometimes you have authority figures actually, you know, restricting people's options in ways that they might not have been able to before, and that's just one of the many issues that we end up talking about.
Absolutely. Let's not get into that now and preempt our conversation for next week, because we've got other things to talk about. First of all, we've just we, we just returned from the BASR / EASR / IAHR conference at Liverpool Hope University, which I have to say was a fantastic event.
It was. We had a whole crew of Religious Studies Project folk there, assistant editors.
Some of which we were meeting in person for the first time. It was great.
Assistant editors, Jonathan Tuckett, and Knut Melvar, and Hannah Lettinen.
As well as many friends, you know, David Wilson, Suzanne Owen,
Liam Sutherland,
Ethan Quillen, anybody else we might have forgotten.
There are absolutely tons of them. Beth Singler. In fact, look at Beth Singler's blog post from a couple of weeks ago, and you'll see just how many names were at the conference.
That was clever, because it only came out yesterday. But for the listener.
Yeah, see, I'm already placing myself 2 weeks in the future. It's fantastic.
We're breaking the fourth wall here, Chris.
Yeah.
So we did interviews.
Mm-hmm. We got three interviews?
Four, if you count the one that Knut did with us.
Yes.
Say no more about that.
There's a very special show for later in the year as well.
That'll come out at some point. As well as we recorded our Christmas special, which I think we're going to put out at Christmas.
Yeah, it would be a bit odd to put it out some other time.
It would require considerable unpacking if we were to do that.
All in all, a really successful conference.
It was a really successful conference, and that was a good thing considering that they had there were some problems with the organising early on in the year. It was very, very good.
It was good to touch base with the BASR just about our connection with them.
A mutually beneficial arrangement by all accounts. So that's great. We're very happy with that arrangement.
Absolutely.
We do have more conferences coming up, although actually Chris and I aren't going to be at it, but we do have the AAR coming up at the start of November, the American Association of Religion?
American Academy of Religion.
American Academy of Religion.
Yeah. It's the BASR equivalent, except for the whole of the state, so you can imagine it's quite a big affair.
Yes, but we do have a similarly large crew going, including several of the same people. David Wilson's going to be there doing a few things for
us.
Suzanne Owen. Jack Zonis is organising it this year. We've got that Per Smith's going to be there.
Per Smith and a couple of our folk who aren't editors yet, but Dusty Hosley and Dave McConaughey, I think, are also in the mix.
Yeah, so that's going to be great. We've got panels, reports, interviews, a round table, a lot of things coming out there, so that's going to be pretty exciting too. Shall we mention the various series we've got coming up, or shall we leave that for another week?
We can mention that we've got a sort of broad series on religion and migration, which, you know, kind of ties in with our religion in a global context last year, though it's slightly different.
We've got more on the psychology of religion, including a very exciting episode where they recorded a live panel at the International Association for the Study of for the Psychology of Religion in France, with a panel of some of the top names in the field, with questions that were supplied by the listeners. So that's going to be great. We haven't quite scheduled that yet, but that'll be a big week, I think.
And then we're filling a major lacuna.
Is this in our theorists series? I'm excited about that, Chris, I have to say. So we should have a block of 4 weeks at least on kind of looking at
classic
theorists, and they're focusing specifically on their contributions to the study of religion, which is, as Chris says, a big lacuna, because there tends to be dictionary entries or full-length works, but not these...
Not podcasts,
and not anything which is that focused just on their approach to religion in a accessible kind of way. So that's something to look forward to.
For now, you know what's happening next week, so we'll just remind you again about amazon.co.uk and .com, and
Facebook, Twitter,
iTunes.
maybe Google Plus.
Yeah, and keep bearing with the new website. And just get in touch, you know. Opportunities Digest, send us an email if you want anything in there.
Hey, drop us a line. We never talk anymore. We miss you guys.
Thanks for listening.